Chapter 2. Congratulations, Mustang says over the phone the next day, sounding gluttonously smug. You've become a national sensation. Again. Ed, who saw the front page of the tabloids in the kiosk when he went to get his breakfast bun that morning, thunks his forehead against the wall and groans. The summer parliamentary session is about to close before the solstice, so if we blow this up big enough, we may be able to squeeze quite a few things through before the holiday. Mustang continues. Variety's interested in doing a piece, interviewing us both, taking photos, the works. So if any reporter finds you before then, you have no comment. And any Cretan contact should go through me. But just in case, if they do get in touch...
Yeah, Ed grumbles. Fuck, an interview? For this? What, are they expecting a deep psychological backstory for not wanting to see some kid eaten? What am I even supposed to say?
Oh, they'll hardly expect you to talk. Their main interest will be in highlighting your mysterious background and potential parentage. Your actions are an opportunity for us, not a reason. Though you could talk about your extensive personal history and exotic animal handling, I suppose, if you really feel you need to say something.
Ed hangs up on his happy ass, which, unfortunately, doesn't actually remove the problem. But he can do an interview. After that, he'll tell him. It's easy to feel more distant the next day, the feelings seeming overblown and miscolored from the night before. But it doesn't mean anything's actually changed. This shit has to stop. And it will, once Ed talks to him. By the time the interview night rolls around, however, it's full midsummer. The heat's coming down like a hammer, and the solstice is 3 days away. Mustang hasn't told Ed they're going to any party for it, which Ed was half expecting. It's a federal holiday. But maybe he celebrates with his family or Hawkeye or has some kind of event Ed doesn't need to be at instead. But there's a chance he'll spring it on Ed today, so Ed will have to tell him right off that it's not on the table. Great. Two shitty conversations in one. Oh, how he's looking forward to this. Mom died 2 days shy of midsummer. Ed's always felt that was particularly unfair. How the warming weather had brought some strength back to her and given them all hope that she'd turned a corner right before dropping it right out from under them again. Ed and Al used October 3rd as their grave day, even before they got their bodies back. Partly because it's impossible to escape summer celebration, even the week beforehand, and it's kind of a downer for them and everybody else when they can't match the mood. It's not really right of them. Grave days are for celebrating a person's life, remembering them well. But Ed doesn't know if he'll ever be able to let the bitterness go. Mom died when she was 26. In a couple of years, Ed's going to be older than she ever got to be. And it's not right, either, to visit her and instead of treating and talking, just sit over her bones and think about how fucking unfair shit can be. But Ed can't help it. Mom was always who he ran to when things weren't fair. She never told him that's just how the world is. She just listened and asked him what he thought they should do next. He figures that wouldn't have changed if she was alive now. She'd understand. So in the summer, Ed doesn't go to her grave. But the date doesn't change and the bitterness doesn't need him to go and fetch it. And he's mad that he's mad, acting like he's the first person to ever lose a mother. As if the pain, insisting its own uniqueness, its importance, ever did anything but make him hurt others worse. On top of that, the weather started up a stop-start thunderstorm cycle, where the air pressure cartwheels up and down the barometer like a chipmunk in a laundry wheel, and the barometric drops make his ports ache like a bitch. It's a particular kind of pain, a hurt that never comes out of season. These days, his automail is mostly just part of him, built in like the cowlix and crooked ring finger and chipped teeth. But pressure fronts play hell on his ports, especially the one that's no longer even there. And sense memory likes to crop up sometimes and give him blood and ozone along with the smell of graveyard earth. It's usually not so bad in cities, where everything smells like food or car exhaust or coal smoke. And there's no sheep smells at all. But being in Central this time only mitigates it a little. Walking back from the university gym, too, takes him past one of Central's giant cemeteries. This one all along the northern rail yard in one long swath of graves. It's an old one, most of the tombs fancy and elevated above ground in pre-reform style. But there's still a few wreaths Ed can see here and there. Bright colors dotting the vibrant grass. Recent visitors. Here in Central, they always cremate. Half because of plague-era laws and half to save space. So you can have whole generations of families all interred in the same casket-sized plot. Pots of incense on the plate stones, so thick sometimes they're stacked in little pyramids on top of each other. It reminds him of Xing a little. Over there, they believe the dead stick around in a pretty literal way. Ancestors living in the family shrines, angry ghosts at the site of their murder, and so on. And incense is one of the ways to talk to them. East Amherst picked up some of that, though diluted and in a fairly haphazard way. When a dead relative sticks around, it's not to do much more than occasionally trip you around a sinkhole or help you find a particularly lost sheep. It's most complete as a theology when it's for kids. When you're little, watching them get the coffin ready, all the relatives and neighbors come and get you to help your dead one last time. Where's Daddy's good hat? Which walking stick was Grandpa's favorite? Which shoes would Mom want to walk far? Because the dead get back up after they're in the ground. They go east. Not really our east, but the other one. The direction you can only go if you're dead. They follow the sunrise. They're going to get born again. This tracks from the straightforward farming and herding perspective, because it's just common sense. Compost becomes dirt, bones become dust, the meat of the stock and the harvest of the field becomes your own flesh in turn. But it also stands to reason that something has to be powering the turn of the seasons, the rise of sap and the burst of flowers every spring, because nothing comes from nowhere and there's no life without fuel. So it follows. The souls, the animating force, must also come back. But babies don't know anything when they're born. People don't remember their past lives. But you get deja vu, and dreams maybe, and some people claim to be psychics and seers. So maybe something happens in between. Maybe they're just gone so long walking they forget. Maybe they have to walk all the way around the world before they can start again, full circle. And wouldn't anyone forget a few things if they did all that? That's why you get buried with some water, a good pair of shoes, if you're poor, a horse if you aren't. In the Western Forest, it's apparently an axe. Near water, it's a boat. And they're happy you're dead. Your favorite dog, your grandpa. They're all fresh and young again in the warm sunlight, in the cool shade. And they don't always go immediately either. They can stick around, help you find lost keys or get a turn of luck at the races. They'll wait for you to come too if that's how you need it, so you can walk together. So they're not gone. But you can't eat when you're dead, and you can't touch the living, and all you get is what's buried with you. And Ed had thought, surely she's waiting for us. And since she's already waiting, wouldn't Mom want to eat again? Wouldn't she want to finish her sewing, her book? Wouldn't Mom just come back with them instead if he and Al went looking? That's the kind of stuff he ends up thinking about whenever the flower garlands go up and the heat lays over the land like liquid coal. And it's good, kind of. Better to think about the little kid stories. Because if he doesn't, he'll end up thinking about the truth, about what really happens when you die, how he'd failed and how he'd succeeded, how he did bring back Al, how he'd had it almost perfect. Better to stick to Sheepland tales. Shepherds have got it the most right of anybody anyway. What they believe in is sheep. So Ed tries to be philosophical about it. But on the day of the interview, he wakes up at 4 in the morning, already knowing there's going to be a storm tonight, shoulder aching like a bitch, even though there's hardly any metal in there anymore. And Al's in Jing without even access to a phone line until he gets down off the latest damn sacred mountain, and they're apart for the first time ever for this shitty shared anniversary. And as Ed stumbles out of bed, he discovers that his period, which has mostly stopped since the tea but still likes to make the occasional surprise appearance, has chosen today to annoy him into the fucking stratosphere. He shows up to the plaza ready to chew a hole in the asbestos of Mustang's public fucking personality. It's because of all this running around with him that Ed's overshot his next tea implant, probably. Between all the bouncing around, he's put off finding a new clinic ever since he moved out of Rush Valley, and Granny's endocrinologist pal retired, which means he doesn't have a local go-to that he can just drop by and go, "Hey, stab me a refill." So he's going to have to find himself a new one, and probably a goddamn gynecologist too, and both of those are going to want at least some of his prior medical documentation. And he doesn't like to go to doctors without a personal reference, so he's going to have to call Granny on the off chance she's heard of anybody in Central who's any good. All that on top of having to tell Mustang he can't handle his shit. Yippee. Having his goddamn chore list interrupted by the approach of Mustang's smug face doesn't improve his mood any. Though Mustang's smile also fades slightly as he comes up to him. "What's wrong?" "The fuck do you care?" Ed says, sharper than he intends, but no sharper than he feels. Mustang can fucking take it. "Let's just go." Mustang lifts a hand, past Ed's jaw, sliding in under his hair to grip at his nape. And suddenly Ed's face is practically mushed into Mustang's shoulder, hidden from public view. "You look angry and miserable, which is a little odd, don't you think, given you're out with me?" He murmurs right in Ed's ear, voice soft but words hard, grip harder. "Did you think I wouldn't address it?" He shakes Ed by the nape, just the slightest bit. "What's the matter?" For a second, not even a faceful of cologne is enough to down the urge to bite Mustang's hand off. But only for a second. The flare of rage dies, and Ed abruptly feels small and stupid and ashamed. There's nothing he can say here that won't make him sound like a 2-year-old with a tantrum. "Wah, wah, it hurts. Wah, wah, my little brother's off doing cool shit and I can't handle a bad day without him. Wah, I'm full of feelings." Ed's handled way fucking worse. If he tells Mustang he's pitching a fit over some bad biology, Mustang will think he's been body snatched. So he says nothing, clunking his forehead further down against Mustang's shoulder. Just this once. He's tired. The fabric of his shirt is light enough that Ed can feel the hot line of Mustang's collarbone, the usual scent of him muddled in the humid air. He'll tell Mustang they have to end this after, Ed decides. Once the interview's done and he's eaten and they're in the car alone, it'll be better that way. "I could get it out of you," Mustang says thoughtfully. That makes Ed snort into his collar, even as a useless little tingle runs down his spine. "Not worth it," he promises, talking around half a mouthful of lapel. "No, just stupid shit." The grip on his neck, actually, is loosening the headache. "Squeeze harder." There's a pause where Ed thinks Mustang's gonna step away instead, but then his grip bites down. After a few moments, Ed feels a fine tremor begin in the arm, and while the hold doesn't quite falter, it does remind Ed that, oh yeah, Mustang got stabbed through both hands, and Ed knows he's got fucky tendons as a result. Ed lifts his head, intending to step back and get a grip already, but Mustang doesn't let him.
"If you aren't ready to smile, don't bother," he says, still in that soft voice. "We have time."
"No, I can't. It's fine." Ed tries to pull away again, but Mustang's still squeezing at Ed's neck, his grip staying firm despite the tremor, giving Ed a don't be difficult look.
"What is it?"
Ed tilts his head just enough to narrow his eyes right back. "What, you never have days where God puts you in a hamster ball and chucks you down the stairs?" Mustang guffaws in his face, and then just as immediately stuffs it, mouth snapping shut even as his eyes go wide and his shoulders shake. "What?" Ed continues, because making the bastard bray like a donkey is the least he can do for himself. "Never had the world put you in a cocktail mixer and just..." He mimes some vigorous shaking. Mustang has to look away, his hand slipping off Ed's neck to cover his own mouth.
"It's nothing fucking new, bastard. What are you, my nanny?"
"Well, if that's the official diagnosis..." Mustang still smiling, his eyes crinkled, but the look in his eyes is still evaluating. Searching.
"Are you all right?"
Ed puffs out his cheeks again and tries to be pragmatic about things, which means he owes Mustang some tactically relevant information. "I'm probably going to throw up at some point tonight." The concern in Mustang's face sharpens briefly, his eyes flicking up and down Ed's body, but to his credit, he doesn't move to wipe his hand on his pants or anything.
"You're sick?"
Ed grimaces and rolls his eyes, largely at himself.
"I'm fine, just fucking PMSing."
Mustang gives him another sharp look, but wisely doesn't press it.
"All right, we have some time before we're due. Should we sit somewhere?"
Ed shakes his head, pulling a face.
"Not in this heat."
They've got time before the rain comes, too. It'll be pissing out here come sundown. But not yet. He is hungry. But it's the uncertain edge of tightrope kind of feeling that he knows too well is just dying to turn into full nausea. The interview is going to be at some private club, the better to add humanizing photos to the spread, whatever that means. And those do tend to have really good food. But anything heavier than, like, salad is probably out of the question for tonight. Fuck. Let's just find a park or something. Fresh air. Or whatever it is you've got here that approximates.
"All right," Mustang says lightly, tipping his head toward the main avenue leading off, lined with trees. "A romantic pre-dinner stroll will hardly hurt the optics."
"Fucking ideal," Ed mutters as they head off down the street, into the evening crowds. "When it's my turn to barf, I'll make sure it's really aesthetic." If Mustang wants to play White Knight for their stalkers, he can hold Ed's hair. Ed turns them off the canal path pretty quick, the smell of the water not doing him any favors today. And that takes them into the lower third, which replaces the wet dog smell with a lot of frying food. Mustang just ambles along, hands in his pockets, content without conversation. And when they come to the park intersection, there's an evening market going on, the lights and music playing somewhere, and people thronging between stalls looks like just the right kind of distraction. "I want to go through there." Mustang eyeballs it, but there's that resigned look to his face. That means Ed's already won.
"You would pick scenarios where my chances of being knifed in a crowd rise significantly."
"You can handle it," Ed informs him.
"I can handle getting stabbed," Mustang mutters.
But he follows when Ed starts walking towards the market.
"You've done it before, haven't you? You're practically a pro."
Then, so as not to lose Mustang and make it convincing, Ed reaches back and hooks Mustang's arm in his, just like Mustang did to him at the embassy, tugging him along and letting his grip slide until they're hand in hand. It doesn't last long, due to the press of the crowd and the fact that it's humid enough that any skin contact gets gross pretty quickly. Which is for the best, given, once again, Ed doesn't know where he'd have gone from there. He's gotta stop doing shit like that, but, well, whatever. It'll all be over soon anyway. He focuses on the stalls instead, which are a giant mess of flea market sprawl, tourist trap crap, and estate sale rejects that really should have gone into donation bins. The cheap lights strung overhead are turning everything piss yellow even before the sun's fully gone down. But it's too nice, despite all that. They haven't really been out alone since that first dinner at the river market. And Mustang's right up against Ed's back with a soft, running commentary of insults about the absolute garbage people are turfing out to sell. Then they fetch right up against an antique bookstall, and Ed stops paying attention to anything except the stacks. Most of it is as garbage as the rest, just the usual collections of pulps and paperbacks rounded up when Grandpa or whoever dies. But he's found extremely cool shit before, in the way of old annotated maps, and once a journal full of pressed Molinaise flowers. There's a bunch of other shit mixed in with these books, too. Old pocket watches and compasses and cigarette cases, little antique chopstick sets, lace and paper fans. He's examining a mummified leather satchel with what looks like claw marks on it, when a familiar embossed script catches his eye. It's a knife, old, with ornate carvings. Xerxian style. Usually thinking about old stuff from their house makes him mad, because there's no use to it and there's nothing he can do. There's no point thinking about how he'd had a favorite shirt once, or how there's literally nothing of Mom's left anywhere. Not her apron, not her hairbrush, not the fancy cloisonné bottle of old perfume that she'd used as a vase for single flowers. At the time, none of that had mattered. Mom was gone. Having her fucking stuff around gathering dust didn't help. It only drove the point home further. Now, though, it's never not gonna hurt. It's not like she'd even had time to name what exactly she'd even wanted Ed and Al specifically to inherit. But having something of hers might have been something. Or maybe not. Probably would have turned out like the state alchemist watch. Bitter reminder and double-edged sword in one portable package. Besides, for all he knows, the walnut hairbrush and cloisonné vase would have gone to Al, and Ed would have gotten her favorite washerboard or something. Not that he wouldn't tote that around, but he'd probably just hit people with it. He turns over the knife, examining the sheath. There's a carved horse head on the pommel, its eyes picked out in shiny gold leaf. The sheath's pretty obviously new, seeing as the leather would have rotted away, but the rest of it feels like the real deal. It's been sharpened and cleaned recently, but the metal itself and the enamel and carvings are all worn down. Xerxian Kinjal, Ed explains, feeling Mustang come up behind him and stop at his shoulder. My dad had one of these. Had to mount it up on the wall, though, after I tried to sacrifice Al to unspecified dark forces with it. Mustang gives a surprised laugh. Ed's own face tugs into a grin, only half reluctant. He put it up right over our bed, though, so I don't know that it was really discouragement.
So much about you suddenly becomes clear, Mustang says amusedly. I must admit, I did wonder where exactly you'd found a suit of 14th century armor in a shepherding village.
Ed pulls a face. Hohenheim had a fuck ton of old weird shit just lying around. Al wasn't the only suit of armor in his workroom. It was just the closest.
More than one?
Yeah, didn't you see? 2 full sets of plate armor and like 8 chainmail shirts. A billion helmets. A bunch of swords, though Mom made him put those away once I started to walk.
Goodness, I can only assume your crib was originally a throne of skulls.
Sheep, actually, Ed admits, sheathing the kinjal. Big fucking wooden thing, done up in wool. One of the neighbors made it, put eyes and teeth on it and everything. Gave Al nightmares from day fucking one. Pretty sure us burning it all down was the only thing that kept it from coming to life and escaping into the hills to eat people. He doesn't regret burning it down, exactly. If it were him now, he might go through Hohenheim's stuff to see what maybe could stay. But most of it was just plain dangerous. But, well, Mom's things and all, their photographs, the pair of shoes in that one poem, never to be worn again.
Would you still do the same now, if given the chance?
Mustang says, doing nothing for Ed's deep, private suspicion that the bastard is some kind of psychic. Ed gives him a sardonic look. Where do you think me and Al got the human array in the first place? It sure wasn't from the Resinbul Public Library. And not because that's just what we called the 12 porn mags stashed in the neighbor's barn. It had to burn. Mustang grins a little, but tips his head slightly in a, yeah, okay, makes sense, movement. He nods at the Kinjal.
Is this what you want?
Ed snorts. Gonna buy me a big old knife to eat my dinner with?
They do say when you go to meet reporters, you should show up armed,
Mustang says cheerfully.
Though if you do, you're going to have to bring it later. I've let the Variety office know they should reschedule.
Hey, no, I can't. Ed starts turning around, then registers that Mustang's holding stuff, a paper cup with some logo on it, and a prescription pill bottle.
A honey ginger tea, Mustang says, lifting the cup, ice cubes clinking, then the little bottle. Painkiller. If you'd prefer something else, one of the Larricks around here should have some alternatives.
Ed stares at him.
You're limping, Mustang says simply. It's not exactly detective work.
I am not, Ed says automatically, squinting at the label.
It's just naproxen, in a higher dose than over-the-counter stuff. Chronic prescription made out to Roy Mustang on 4-12-20.
These are expired, he has to point out, by like 3 years.
Mustang shrugs slightly. They still work as of last Wednesday.
Your middle name's Marge? Not everyone does matronymics, true, but Ed kinda assumed if Mustang had an un-Amstrian name, he would have changed it in accordance with his little megalomaniac dreams, even before he enlisted into the military. Marge is practically Drachman.
Mustang rolls his eyes. There isn't room to print Margaritian on there, and I'm honestly not sure why they tried. Are you going to have any, or can I stop standing here like the saddest drug dealer in the city?
Ed takes it, popping four and swallowing dry, ice cubes knocking against his teeth as he chases it with tea. You're from the north?
Born in Central, Mustang says as he takes the pills back and pockets them. Before that, Ujat, little place near Fort Curson.
Oh, are you Kma?
Mustang shakes his head again. Jingis, mixed.
What, really? Ed quits slurping on the cup to double-take at Mustang's face, like that'll somehow deliver previously unavailable information. He just assumed Mustang was from the northeast border like teacher, because there's like six different ethnicities up there that wouldn't stand out in a Jingis lineup, and the entire Triplet River's delta is full of people who came from the islands back in, like, 1600-whatever. It's not really uncommon, though. Like, every third Amstrian is mixed on account of all the conquering and assimilation, and unlike for Arugans or Drachmans, it's not illegal for Jingis people to live and work here. Come to think of it. Wait, Hughes too?
Our grandmothers immigrated in the 50s, before the borders closed. But his mother was Jingis and his father Amstrian.
Oh, Ed says. Huh, I didn't know you were mixed too.
Mustang makes a dismissing sort of gesture. It doesn't much show. Both my parents were mixed as well. There's Jingis blood on both sides.
Huh, Ed repeats. Is it still half for you if you like that? Like, mathematically. A quarter from your mom, a quarter from your dad?
I suppose so. Mustang agrees tolerantly. I've never thought about it over much. Most people do assume I'm Kama, in any case.
And he doesn't correct them, Ed assumes, is the silent back half of that sentence. Better not to be any kind of foreign in Mustang's line of work.
What's your clan?
Mustang shrugs, not looking very invested in the topic.
My parents died when I was 4. There are no surviving grandparents. They didn't leave much in the way of familial records or cultural memorabilia. And in any case, my grandmothers were most likely exiles or refugees. Both my parents were born right after the border closings, so I imagine they weren't eager to lean into the foreign half of their heritage.
Oh, Ed says again. Not much else he can say to that. It'd probably be too morbid to ask what they died of, even for him. What'd they do?
My mother was a mathematics professor at a university.
Mustang tips his head in what Ed understands to be the vague direction of CUA campus.
And my father was on the janitorial staff. They had quite the romance, I'm told. Notes left on desks and anonymous flowers and so forth.
Ed doesn't know why that's such a surprise. Because if Mustang did come from big money like the Armstrongs, then it's not like everyone wouldn't know. It must be written all over his face, though, because Mustang raises his eyebrows, mouth curling. Ed flushes, glad, as always, that it doesn't much show.
I don't know. You act rich.
I am rich, Mustang says easily. And I grew up expensive. Of course, I'm sure you could say the attitude came naturally.
Ah, shut up, Ed grumbles. What do you mean expensive? Mustang twiddles his fingers.
Military boarding school.
Seriously? Ed didn't previously have much of a frame of reference, but being in university has exposed him to the rest of the world's constant competitive grind of academic one-upsmanship. If you're an orphan, enlisting is a pretty solid career bet, sure, but the military academies don't just take anyone, and it's only the officer candidate school that's free, if you make it through boot camp.
Where do you go?
Vocat Rodley.
Are you serious?
Oh, yes. Even with the alchemy scholarship, I was tutoring on the side whenever I had time.
Of fucking course you did, you fucking nerd. Fuck, did you do a sport?
Oh my god. Ed's briefly struck dumb by the idea of teenage Mustang, moon face and mop haired, and completely failing to fill out his tennis whites. Which does, in fact, do wonders for tranquilizing his pants raccoon.
Did you play tennis?
Mustang gives him a very, ha ha, keep laughing, jock look.
Chess team.
Ed cackles. Oh, that explains everything. Straight out of short pants into officer school, huh?
Barely stopped to report in before I took the state exam, if you ask my instructors.
Maybe it's the thought of tiny Mustang on the tennis court, but it makes Ed suddenly wonder what it'd look like, a Mustang who had never put on the uniform. What would you have been if you didn't commission? Mustang gives him a surprised glance, but clearly doesn't even have to think about the answer.
An alchemist. I had the talent, and the money I made freelancing, even as an apprentice, was necessary for me to afford school. And I did not, as you noted, come from a background where that could be passed up.
Then he makes a sour little face, like he's just discovered a worm in his apple.
Of course, I did commission.
He gives Ed a "you'll like this" look, though this one is tinged with something like irony.
Graduated valedictorian.
Ha! Did you go and give a speech?
Oh, yes. On the Civil War, in fact.
It's not that he's regretful, or even bitter-sounding, but he's got that particular flavor of amusement all over his face. Something only just barely too sardonic to be discussed.
Not that any other topics would have been permitted at the time, But that certainly didn't curb my enthusiasm any. I felt quite right, even.
It's kind of uncomfortable to see the look aimed inward. Ed looks back at the stalls instead.
Margarita's a nice name.
It is, Mustang allows.
He doesn't quite sound like Ed's poked a sore spot. But then again, Mustang doesn't flinch when someone presses where it hurts.
Though my father was Jinli, and allegedly, due to an unfortunate attack of humor, I was very nearly named Rumlin to match.
Rumlin?
Yes.
Wow! Ed marvels. Makes Roy feel like a blessing, huh? Mustang sighs like all the burdens of the world are upon him.
They were hoping for a girl. It was going to be Regina.
Of course they were. Ed grins away at the stalls. I was Edith for a bit, until we found out I was a boy.
That's not so bad. Same route, even.
Yeah, exactly. Wasn't much of a change. Ed's thigh twinges, right then, sharp enough to cut him off, clicking his mouth shut so he wouldn't make the noise in his throat. He grimaces. Let's go sit down.
All right, Mustang says,
half a second off enough to know he's caught what's coming up, but once again is smart enough not to press it. They're halfway across the park lawn when the sky finally opens. A little warning patter at first, and then it's like a hatch opens up in the sky and drops an ocean on them. They both begin to jog at the same time, then run. The yells of traders trying to cover up their merch behind them beginning to fade as they get deeper into the ginsengs. Ed's all for just cutting straight through and finding some street awning. Running on this leg right now is not fun. But Mustang calls,
"Here,"
and swerves to the right, leading them into a glade of willows and a granite pavilion. There's a statue here of a platoon around a rearing horse, and it creates a surprisingly sizable overhang. The rein kept off by the outflung metal cape or flag or whatever around the horse. Of course, this does require them to basically sit directly under its faithfully rendered nuts. Classy, Ed mutters, flicking the brass balls with one fingernail. They're shined gold against the patina of the rest of the statue, a testament to the undying and universal tenets central to the human spirit. You take all your dates here or what?
Where do you think all the students trade cigs between classes?
Mustang nods out at the trees as he settles himself down on the plinth next to him.
Radley's just across the street. This should clear up in a few, though. We can wait it out.
Ed looks out across the monument pavilion to where the edges of a blocky gray compound are visible through the gaps in the trees. Oh, wow. I've seen nicer prisons.
Mustang snorts. Prisoners get locks on their doors.
He pulls an ignition glove out of his pocket.
For 6 months during fifth year, I had a broken radiator. 9 classes a week, and only the one uniform. Showing up in unsuitable dress was a demerit. Wet clothes counted. And that was about as fun as having to freeze in those classrooms. So you can imagine how much fun I was having. Luckily,
he finishes tugging on the glove. Grins at Ed in a way that takes 10 years off his face. Not the usual smug satisfaction, but a contagious excitement. A promise that he's about to show something good.
That only lasted until I learned how to deconstruct water.
Ed snorts. Without shredding your uniform?
Without shredding my uniform. Quite a few rags became papier-mâché in the testing stages, I'll admit. But by the end of term, I was making enough to quit tutoring just by stopping off every day to dry an entire dorm's laundry.
So if I dumped that water on your head, Ed says, unable to help his own smile, back when you showed me the movie poster, what would happen?
Mustang looks surprised by the implication, then intrigued. Well, I'd still have gotten wet, he says, looking down at his hands, pulling an ugh. Fine sort of face, and then tapping them together.
Seriously? With your transmutation time? Ed watches Mustang touch his own chest, alchemy crackling over him and his clothes rippling faintly as the water on him disassembled to its component atoms. You're not that fucking slow. Though this transmutation here is, it's a 3-second deal, which is frankly kind of embarrassing for an alchemist with both Mustang's reaction time and facility with gases. Ed eyeballs his hands, which had made contact with each other like a sorority girl dared to lick a swamp toad. You really don't like doing that, huh? It's incredibly uncomfortable. Mustang makes another face, stripping his glove back off and tucking it back into his pocket, unused. And anyone's transmutation time increases when building an array off the cuff, which is what happens every time with the clapping and doesn't exactly make it more comfortable. The charge isn't meant to be sustained inside you, disturbing origins aside. All the charges come through you? Ed tells him. That's what the gate inside everybody even is. And the charge doesn't stay in you any longer than a usual array if you do it right. You just push it out and go. You just need to get better at it. You've got the capability. You should be vaporizing people's drinks before they even hit you.
I think you're vastly overestimating the number of drinks I get dumped on me.
Mustang grumbles, tapping his hands together again, this time reaching out to touch the transmutation to Ed's shoulders. Other people's alchemy washing over him is pretty familiar at this point, if not exactly pleasant. But Mustang's exacting enough with his energy allocation that it's hardly a whisper of discharge coursing over him in one head-to-toe wave. It's efficient, warming as it goes, as the H2O splits. And the transmutation doesn't touch his hair, which is for the best, given it already probably looks like it got used as an aquarium filter. Mustang watches him through it, though, a thoughtful look on his face, and Ed doesn't quite know what to do besides stare back.
What would you be doing? Mustang asks, not quite out of nowhere as the transmutation dies down, and he takes his hands away. If not alchemy.
Good question. Well, even if Hohenheim never fucked off, we still would have been involved, Ed reasons, gathering up his hair and leaning over so as not to squeeze it right back onto his dry shirt, in the whole homunculi apocalypse thing.
Because your father learned of the nationwide array?
Well, yeah, and I don't know, even if we weren't sacrifices, we probably still would have been right in the middle of it, because, you know, family, Ed snorts. Ha! Technically, you helped me murder my uncle. He wrings some more water out of his hair before he registers that Mustang's frowning at him.
Your uncle?
Yeah, that fucking mega homunculus thing you and Hawkeye torched a bunch. Ed pulls a face. Though, okay, like, I don't even know how that shit would work with clones, and let's not even talk about what that would make my cousins.
Clones, Mustang says carefully.
That's what the thing was. It cloned Hohenheim back in Xerxes, so that's why... Right, you were blind. Anyway, it looked exactly like him before it started getting all... Ed trails off, realizing the rest of that sentence pretty much goes, started looking like me. He's so far avoided talking about that with everyone who did actually see it. Only... Mustang might be the only person he can talk to about it, because it's not like Mustang's gonna give any fraction of a shit, let alone psychoanalyze it. Kinda looked like me, actually. Like, a lot. It was fucked up. Creepy as shit. Mustang briefly looks worried around himself, like he can't find somewhere to put this information. Which has Ed worried there will be psychoanalysis for a second, before Mustang opens his mouth.
It cloned your father?
Oh, yeah, when he got turned into... Ed accidentally yanks on his scalp, discovering his wet hair's gotten tangled at his nape, caught in his necklace. He winces and starts picking it apart. A philosopher's stone. It's why he didn't need to clap to transmute, or an array or anything. Well, you know. Anyway, the Xerxes thing was keeping the original homunculus thing alive by feeding it Hohenheim's blood. So when they killed off everybody in Xerxes, it turned itself into a copy of him, and Hohenheim into a kind of copy of itself, I guess. It put half of all the souls into him. Ed remembers how Id healed him up, patted his head, enthused about Hohenheim like an old friend. It liked him. Or it thought it did. For a while, anyway. Probably not so much at the end. Mustang is still looking at him in that wrenched in the gears way.
I had been under the impression that your father had passed away, he says, almost delicately.
Ed snorts. Oh, that fucker's dead as a doornail. He sloped off when nobody was looking, went all the way to Rezimbul to Mom's grave, and fucking died on it. Left another body for Granny to clean up. At least he healed up Teacher a bit before he went. Despite talking about Hohenheim, Ed finds he's actually feeling pretty cheerful. It's unexpectedly invigorating to be able to tell the truth. And the fact that Mustang apparently didn't even know about all this is hilarious. What, worried you were going to get a shovel talk?
Not really, no, Mustang says slowly. Even if he were alive, he's clearly not present in your life.
Ha! If only Mustang knew. The bitch was barely present in his own life. You know, knowing what I do now, I honestly don't know if it would have made any difference if he hadn't fucked off. The guy wasn't exactly... Like, Mom was already raising us on her own, you know? Even when Hohenheim was right there with her, he was just some guy in our house. And like, whatever, I get it. He was super fucked up and could probably barely focus on what day it was. But like, explain that to your 2-year-old. Ed shrugs, focusing on his hair. He might have loved us, but he wasn't any good at it.
He left to set up the counter circle, Mustang says, still sounding like he's trying to draw a mental map in his head. The one triggered by the eclipse's umbra.
Yeah, took off when I was 5. And sure, he was saving the fucking world or whatever. But fucking of course he didn't tell Mom that, or write a letter, or spare a single goddamn phone call for the entire fucking decade he was gone. For all we knew, he was dead in a ditch somewhere, Ed says disgustedly. And then Mom died that summer, so...
Mustang glances at him, but still with that slight frown of mentally arranging a timeline. You lived with your automail mechanic?
Ed shrugs. A bit. Me and Al decided pretty early to, you know, when we found the array in Hohenheim's stuff. So we went looking for an alchemy teacher. I was about 7. Anyway, we lived with her for a couple of years in Dublin. Once we figured we knew enough to pull it off, we came back and, you know, the rest.
I don't know that I do, Mustang mutters. When you say cousins...
The homunculi, Ed says, finally managing to yank his stupid hair tie out. Then he stops with it halfway to his mouth, because now that he said it out loud... Forget the Xingyi's fetish. Did he fuck his cousin? Half-cousin? Demonic half-brother thing? But no. No, it doesn't work that way. It's not like the homunculi were father's children, even if it was Hohenheim's clone. He is not in any biologically relevant way related to Greed. And in any case, it was Ling's body. Yeah, Ling was there too. It was entirely his body. It's fine. Ed can go on skating by without qualifying for that final quintessential redneck joke. It's bad enough he and Wynn dated enough that Granny got some pointed broccoli casseroles from neighbors and all those comments about how convenient it was that they'd have all the baby pictures from both sides of the family already in the same photo. Cousin Fucker is just, well, he might as well pack it up and go hump sheep. Mustang looks like he boarded his own perilous mental freight line, but did not arrive at any such satisfactory conclusion.
Was your mother aware that...
Oh, God. It's true. Mom also had... She had kids with a living philosopher's stone.
That Hohenheim was, ugh, I mean, she had to, and, like, Granny knew, and that's how Hohenheim even met Mom in the first place. I can't imagine Granny wouldn't have told her, if not before she got pregnant, then at least after. Greed had assured Ed and Ling both that there was absolutely no chance of Ed getting knocked up, or for that matter, catching anything. Which was great, given their access to prophylactics was a bit fucking limited while on the run in the woods, and transmuting rubber is a bitch and a half without base materials. But Hohenheim wasn't a homunculus and pretty empirically worked differently. His body was used as the receptacle for the energy from all the people of Xerxes. And it's not like they had any idea of what that might do on the biological level to any offspring. But, you know, Mom was with him already. Not like she didn't have it in her heart to love a couple more freaks. Ed has to take a second to re-prop his left leg up in a way that'll ease the throbbing a little. But when he looks back up, Mustang's just looking at him. There's a little of that wariness in his face that people give Ed these days when he doesn't soften himself. And Ed has to admit, okay, maybe it's not just that he's bigger and broader now, wider and meaner. It's that he's reached into places nobody was ever meant to go. Not once, but over and over. Part of him had lived there, in the gate, worn like a trophy, bound to the thing that defines the boundaries of life and death. And Ed took it back. There's marks from that that probably won't fade, even if they don't quite always show. But Mustang's been there too, and the look in his eyes isn't wariness of what he doesn't understand, fear of the unknown. He does know. He knows where Ed has been and done. And he took back what was taken from him too. It's the caution of a general, acknowledging a known if unpredictable threat. And it's relief, almost, as though Mustang has nodded to Ed. I see it too. They may have won their little flesh, but they can't pretend they did much more than survive. There's so much they don't understand, can't understand without risking more than what it would be worth to dig. Something from beyond reality wanting to eat their whole nation, raised them all up like livestock for slaughter and very nearly succeeded, and they barely even know what it was. It's too costly to go looking. And Mustang has set himself against it. Taken the defense onto his own shoulders, whatever may come. The Minister of War isn't just the attack dog of Amstrus's Führers. Mustang's held the saber that hangs above the great stair of the rebuilt entry hall into the HQ, the terminus of the entire promenade, and sworn the oath to protect their country and all the people in it. All of that might be nothing more than the trappings that got piled on like show tassels on beef cattle, but it's their country, their nation, still standing, no less real for having begun as a lie. And Ed can see in his eyes that Mustang takes it seriously. He knows better than anyone what Amstrus needs defending from. Humans, monsters, itself.
Your mother must have been an extraordinary woman, Mustang says somewhat thoughtfully.
Yeah. The older Ed gets, the closer he gets to being older than she'd ever been, ever would be, the more he realizes that's true. Hohenheim was a weird, reclusive nut, even without all the immortality shit. Ed grew up in the man's study. He'd know. And Mom had to do a lot of stuff alone. That's brave. He doesn't want to be sad about it now, though. Not when he's spent so much time on that this week already. I should probably just be glad she's not around to make me answer questions about what the hell I'm doing. He eyes Mustang critically. Though, come to think about it, asshole alchemist twice my age who helped fuck up an entire country? She'd probably laugh about how I'm following in her footsteps and pat your hand when you tell her you're a war criminal. Mustang looks like several of his trains of thought abruptly crossed paths and caused a certain amount of fatalities.
I'm not
twice your age, he decides, is his response to that.
But at one point you were, Ed points out.
That's not. I've been twice Riza's age also, and that was when I was 10. You've been twice Alphonse's age.
Don't try to weasel out of this with math. I know more math than you,
Ed says reprovingly.
You're old. The numbers don't lie.
Older every minute spent with you,
Mustang mutters, clearly letting it go with conscious effort. Then reaches out, beckoning.
Give me that. You're going to rip it all out. You shed like a molting collie as it is.
What?
You know I can do it, Mustang says, exasperated. Your hair. Let me fix it.
For a long second, Ed can only stare at him, hands stilled in his snarled ponytail. Mustang just looks put upon and patient, waiting for Ed to let him do it. Like he can't imagine why Ed wouldn't. Like it's nothing at all. The scent of him is almost gone under the rain, but that's almost worse, because the fainter it is, the more Ed tries to catch it. He wants to ask Mustang, why? Ask him, not just assume there's a reason he's not being told. It's worse than wanting to kiss him. He knows that's a dead end, but this feels like it could actually get somewhere. Like it could help. Ed wants to understand. Later on, Ed's going to blame all that, as well as the fact that he was basically 3 inches from ground zero of Mustang in a wet shirt for what falls out of his mouth next. It really doesn't bother you at all? Mustang's face goes bemused.
You don't shed that much.
No, I mean, Mustang raises politely inquiring eyebrows, and something awful starts to tickle at Ed's hindbrain. This stuff, it's not weird for you? He gestures between them. The dating, the touching, because I'm, you know, into you? Mustang blinks. He blinks again.
You're,
he says carefully, like he's hoping, like hell he heard wrong.
Into me?
Adrenaline spikes, washing Ed cold and then hot, tensing him all over. He's just made a mistake. Something has gone terribly, grindingly wrong. Mustang's not laughing it off. He's not pretending he didn't hear. He's not giving a little condescending smile and slicking the convenient little movement away with glib sentences about how, of course not, they're friends. How could there be awkwardness over something so inconsequential? He didn't know. Mustang didn't know. And if Mustang didn't know, then what Ed's just upchucked is the dumbest fucking thing he could have done. Because if Mustang didn't know, then he didn't know about it. He didn't know. He could have stayed not knowing.
Ed?
Mustang says when Ed doesn't answer. Too long. And he sounds more awkward than Ed's ever heard. Not just on him, but possibly on anybody.
I know we've been spending a lot of time together.
What?
Ed's jerked back into motion by incredulity. You think this didn't start now? I've been... Luckily, there's a frustrated noise already building in Ed's throat, so he can end the sentence with that instead of just hanging himself on it.
It's not because you bought me some dinners. Fuck!
Mustang's face is now that of a man with both hands on identically colored wires whose ends both terminate in a ticking pipe bomb.
Since when?
Since whenever. I don't fucking know. Who cares?
Mustang is just staring at him.
You've never said anything.
Say anything? Like what? I wasn't doodling your name in some notebook,
Ed says sharply. This is not how he thought the conversation would go.
Look, it isn't,
he can't say it's not a big deal. Let's just call it off, because it is a big deal. It's why he's calling it off. It doesn't matter, he says, and it comes out too angry, but he can't help it. The point is, we have to stop. I'm not doing this anymore. Mustang, however, is just starting to look confused, uncertain. Like, some numbers just aren't adding up for him, and he doesn't understand why he suddenly can't do math. Ed, he says again, then stalls out, now looking eerily lost. Ed, I've hit you. What? I've hit you, Mustang repeats. Discomfort sits so awkwardly on his features that it makes itself look false. But Ed knows Mustang works his own face like a pianist, and he'd never make himself look so bad on purpose. It doesn't really lay a foundation for that kind of feeling, is all I... What? Ed says incredulously. Mustang, what the fuck are you... Everybody's hit me. Winry hits me every time we're in the same room. Greed beat the shit out of me and we still fucked so much. I still owe Darius and Hankel apology dinners. And like, no offense, Mustang, but you punch like a bitch. Greed? Mustang says. You... He cuts himself off, mouth practically clicking shut, which only fuels the low, hot bed of coals growing in Ed's gut. Yeah, he says meanly. He doesn't know what the fuck lever that just pulled, but he figures it's worth giving another yank. Fuck yeah, Greed. Had to lose my virginity somehow, right? And lucky for him, I don't think getting hit's a turnoff. Though, you know, even I'm aware that shit's a bit much for dinner conversations. He makes himself shut his mouth on that, dial it back. So you can tuck it the fuck back in, Mustang. You ain't special. Ed, Mustang starts again, a sentence that doesn't know how to end. That isn't, he tries again. I don't actually. Ed feels himself start to flush, a dull, unpleasant heat starting at the base of his throat. Yeah, well, I'm messed up, he snaps, real anger beginning to rise. Can't tell me that's new either. He's never been too much for Mustang. To find out that this is what sends him into hysterics is not exactly a thrill. Just forget I said anything. Mustang's mouth is hardening, though, going flat with displeasure. The awkwardness and bewilderment tightening back into a more familiar control. Look, if it's a matter of the physical, then... Ed does not want to find out how Mustang will finish that sentence. Then what? Mustang exhales through his nose, now actually looking impatient. Edward, I understand how... I'm hardly unaware of how I look. You're young. This has been taking up a lot of your time. You're not finding individuals of interest in your peer group.
Ed cannot fucking believe what he's hearing. Mustang, what the fuck are you trying to... What? Convince me I don't like you, actually?
No, I understand quite well that you do, Mustang says, his expression tighter with every word. Like now he's mad. Like he has a right to be. I thought you'd know quite well how to work out the relevant urges, but if you'd like it spelled out, what we're doing hardly precludes you from finding other partners.
Ed'll say this for Mustang. He knows how to sear a wound shut.
For the love of fuck. He says, abruptly exhausted.
Do the interview yourself, if you think I'm just fucking whatever. If you really think this is about me not getting enough ass, then just spare us both and don't call me back.
Mustang starts to look angry then, really angry. But Ed's pushing himself up from the plinth, and Mustang doesn't stop him, and Ed doesn't turn back. The rain's been slowing as they talk. Downpour easing into one of the stop-go lulls of a summer shower. So it's just a scattering of droplets from the trees coming down on him as he walks, pavement streaming as he gets out of the park and finds the nearest trolley stop. A lot of leaves had fallen down in the sudden downpour, making bright, pale patterns against the road, gleaming wet and gold in the streetlights. Between the glow and the rising mist and the lack of people, nothing on the street looks real. Well, that both hadn't gone how he'd expected and not. It's not like he expected Mustang to celebrate the conversation with open arms, but what a fucking dismissal. Sure, Ed sleeps around, but he thought Mustang knew him better than that. Understood him better than that. At least he's not angry anymore. He's just sore, damp, nauseated, and hurting. His joints feel raw, his hair a wet tangle sliding water down his spine, and he's wearing a tampon. He starts laughing, because what the fuck else is there? Now, of course, he's the freak cackling to himself alone on public transit. But good God, what an absolute circus. He might as well honk his nose and throw whitewash while he's at it. It's not like this changes anything. It's not like this is news. So, turns out Mustang didn't know. So what? That makes it better, doesn't it? That he wasn't pushing Ed into this as some backhanded reward or something too callous to be a tease. He wasn't just expecting Ed to deal without letting it affect his plans. That Mustang didn't know him inside and out and just didn't care. Mustang just read him wrong. He just didn't know. He didn't know. Well, now he does. The end. Author's notes. Roy. Silence. Roy.
Well, you really fucking nailed that one, Mustang.
The music used for this podfic is Professional by Samata, featuring Hail Luna. If you enjoyed this podfic, you can leave feedback for both myself and for the author. You can find the podfic post at archiveofourown.org/users/opalsong. And from the podfic post, you can find a link to the text post. Thanks for listening!